Listening to the Food Talk Show. Hi there, my name is Sue Nelson, and for the next hour or so, we're going to be talking about all things food. I'm joined by my fellow presenters, Guy Routledge of Food Rush and Ollie Lloyd of Great British Chefs. And there's a lovely smell pervading the studio, and it's not you, Ollie.
It's my new aftershave.
No, it's not. No. You're excited, aren't you, Guy?
I am. Good afternoon, Sue. It's great to be back.
Yes. Well, we've had a little break. Now we're back. Now, in front of me, I've got lovely curries that have just been made and look like onion bhajis. Paratas or something like that, and some sauce, and I've got spoons and plates. And the reason for that is because we are joined by Legina Liel. Hello, Legina.
Hello.
It's so nice of you to bring me my lunch. I'm so pleased because I haven't had any. And I know Ollie pathetically bought an apple and a something with him.
Yeah, rubbish.
For your lunch. So yeah, you're overjoyed.
I was really depressed coming in.
Yeah, you're overjoyed, aren't you? So we're going to talk about stuff to do with spices. And Legina's got on a really interesting company called Legina Masala. So we'll talk about that. And we're also joined by Julie Bennett. Hi, Julie.
Hello.
Julie works for Precipice Design, but actually we love her because she's a futurist. So I'm really interested to find out all the things that you think we should be looking out for in terms of brands and food trends. I know you've written some amazing articles recently, so we want to suck all that stuff out of your brain and learn what you think is going on. So that'll be the second half of the programme.
We'll take a journey to the future.
The journey to the future. Yeah. Right, now, more importantly, let's talk about my stomach now. So, Legina, before we talk about your company, can you tell us what we've got in front of us? So, bearing in mind vegan month has just finished, and I know you were doing the vegan thing for a month, weren't you, Guy?
I was, yeah. It went quite well, actually. I also did dry January.
Dry and vegan?
Yeah, it was
your body must be going, what is going on?
Yeah, it kind of felt like a terrible idea to begin with, but it actually went really, really well. And you know,
do you feel amazing?
I feel a little bit slimmer, and I think, you know, after the indulgences of the Christmas period, drinking less and eating less of that rich food, I think it definitely did help.
I've
stopped eating.
With
it, to be honest.
That's what I do.
I'm gonna see how long I can go.
Yeah, I just stop eating for a couple of days. That normally does it. No, it's fine. No, you don't need to do all that vegan thing then.
Yeah, I didn't do vegan January.
No.
I tried to cut down on meat, though.
Yeah, I don't eat a lot of meat anyway, but...
I think that's definitely one of the big trends that we're going to see this year. I mean, I think we were chatting to, or I was chatting to Tessa Stewart recently about this idea of plant-based. And, you know, do you call it veganism or plant-based? And whatever term you use to describe it, I think it's definitely going to be a growing trend that we see this year.
I'm all for that, but not permanently, you know, not for every meal. I think if you can do much more of that, that's great, but not for every meal.
I mean, everything in moderation.
Can you stop talking to that guy? Because I want to eat.
You want some lunch, fair enough.
We'll return to that because I'm sure it will come up with Julie. So what have we got in front of us?
So we've got some pakoras that I made using the vegetables from my veg box last week. So we had some peppers, spinach, potatoes, aubergine, and fresh coriander.
You can have those, Guy.
They all sound good to me.
Tamarind.
Mm-hmm.
Just a tamarind drizzle. I've made a dal because I love dal. And this is a vegan one. So there's no butter in it whatsoever. I've made butter chicken because this is what everybody thought.
Ollie and I love that. Get your hands off, Guy.
You can dig in.
So butter chicken, the reason it's come about... is because I teach people to cook Indian food, and sometimes it's on camping stoves in corporate venues, and butter chicken doesn't take long to make and you don't have to spend ages frying onions, so that's the reason.
Perfect.
And it's become a favourite within the business. And I made
they're
homemade naans that I made.
Homemade naans.
So the all.
Can you have
this
those?
Is all homemade.
No, I don't know.
No, there's butter in them. I'm afraid.
Yeah, oh dear, what a shame.
But you can have bhajis and you can have dal. there's those two dishes.
Okay.
Well, two out of four ain't bad.
So we've got some little plates. Would you mind? No, don't pander to him.
Don't apologise.
Would you mind sort of dishing up? Should we start with the dal? A little pakora on the side, if you won't mind being mum, if you'll pardon the expression. So lentils. Now, you can buy the whole lentils or you can buy split lentils. Preferably not in a tin, I would suggest. So what if you have split lentils, which are the ones that are sort of like half a lentil, you can literally cook those within 20 minutes, can't you?
Yeah.
You don't really need to soak them. If you have whole lentils, do you need to soak them overnight?
No, you don't. Even chickpeas you don't have to soak for a little bit, but not you don't necessarily have to soak them overnight.
So how long would you soak them for?
I rarely do. If I was making chickpeas, I actually recently had a client made chickpeas without soaking them, giving them a quick rinse and straight into the slow cooker, and it worked.
Mm. Oh, okay.
So that was new.
A lot of the time they come in water, though, don't they? So
in tins they do,
but if
you're buying the dried dried ones.
I always think the tins... Oh, blimey. That's lovely. I always think the tinned ones actually absorb a little bit of water, though, and I don't find the lentils or
they don't have... They have the...
Don't you think they're... So would you buy tinned lentils, then, to make this sort
if
of...
If I was in an absolute...
Panic.
I've made these chanals. I've made them from... I've just soaked them and put them in the pressure cooker and then curried them up later as a torca.
Hmm. So the thing I do know about lentils is that you really must wash them and wash them and wash them so that you get rid of the water's quite cloudy. So keep soaking them, get rid of all that cloudiness until the water's clear, and then you start cooking with them. Is that right?
That's right.
Mm, the smell is amazing. Ollie's just chewing away, nodding peacefully.
This is the sort of heat I like. Not spicy enough for you, I don't think, Ollie. Mm. Good though, isn't it?
Mm, very good.
Very tasty.
Mm. Very good.
And this is completely vegan, so it's got no butter, no anything in it. How can you not cook with butter? I love butter.
I'm also a big fan, but you know.
And you're vegan. Mm.
For now.
Temporarily.
Mm. Temporarily, yes.
Mm. Mm. Can I have a comment from you, Ollie?
Yeah, sure. I mean, what's interesting about Indian food, and I think particularly in this country, is that more and more people are not cooking British food. And we've got a big survey out at the moment, which will be coming back in a couple of weeks. But, you know, if you talk to foodies, almost a majority of them would say that half of their home cooking isn't British. Mm. What they're defining as British, that's self-defined. And, you know, and actually it's all about, you know, Indian, Chinese, Italian, French, and then, you know, the growing group of more international cuisines, whether that's Mexican or Thai or Japanese or Spanish or whatever else it is. But I think, you know, there's so much interest in understanding how to cook good Indian food nowadays.
But is that the same in other countries, though? I mean, you know, is that the same in America? Is it the same in France?
I think we are particularly international in our lens. And look, if you look at the spectrum of top-end chefs that operate here, it is... You know, it's literally from every country in the world. Mm. And I think we are very committed to producing...
But is that just London or is that across the whole of the UK?
It's more across the whole of the UK than you probably suspect.
Right.
And the research we're about to get is going to break this down nationally on a national panel basis. So we've always looked at just through our audience of foodies, but we're about to get the breakdown of, you know, where are people picking things up? I mean, I'm sure, you know, Mexican food is probably not big in rural Scotland, but there will be Mexican restaurants in Edinburgh, there are Mexican restaurants in Glasgow. So, you know, that's an emerging food trend that, you know, and if you walk down the world food aisle, there are Mexican brands on sale.
Mm. So returning to your lovely dal here, it's a really cheap meal, isn't it?
It's really cheap.
You know, if you had a bit of a tough Christmas and you know, you're saving on the old pennies a little bit for the beginning of the year, actually you can make the most amazing meal just with lentils, which, let's face it, I mean, how much is a bag of lentils? Not a lot, is it? And then any leftover vegetables, any bits of herbs you have in the fridge, or anything, and then some really great spices.
So I've cooked the dal up, finished it off as you normally would, let it cool down, and then I add fresh tomatoes, spring onions and coriander into it. And I think it just brings it to life again.
Gives it a little bit of crunch and texture.
For here, I put them in, so I didn't forget yesterday, but normally I put them in as you serve it. Mm. And I think it's just so lovely to have that extra freshness and healthy.
And a different texture as well, I guess, if you're putting in something fresh and crisp. It goes nicely with the softness of the lentils.
Ollie's diving in for seconds, aren't he?
Silence.
And so what spice mix did you make with that? Because it's got that very sort of turmeric colour, almost like, you know, you sort of get that greeny yellow sort of colour. So what exact spices have you put in there? Because that's your specialism.
So when I start, I used to be an accountant, and when...
Sue's just reached for the dial.
Back in the day when I used to cook for friends and things, I realised that I could make a spice mix that you could just chuck into some fried onions and turn into a curry sauce, because that's what Indian mums do. They make this base up, it sits in your freeze, and every time you want to make a curry, you use this same base for each curry you make. And
what's in that base?
So it's usually fried onions.
Yep.
Ginger, garlic, turmeric, chilies, that's it. No garam masala, because the garam masala will go in at the end.
And is that like a sort of, it's slightly liquidy or?
It's like a firm paste.
Paste, yeah.
It's a firm paste with your tomatoes, and it just sits in packs. They'll put it in a tub and they'll sort of mark it out so you can take one portion at a time. And when I became in charge of my household, I kind of decided that I just wanted to fry my onions up as and when I made my curries. And I used to, just because I think it takes hardly any time to fry an onion if you're watching over it. So I used to make these mixes as I went along, the dried mixes, and I'd give them to my friends as I was creating them for myself to make the same base as I do. And that's where my first ever curry invention came along, which is my curry masala. And it's literally just the ginger, garlic, chilies, garam masala, and just a few bits and pieces that I would add, like the paprika, because it gives you a nice sauce and a nice finish. So I would just make this base up that you chuck in fried onions, and I use it in all my curries. If I make 20, 30 curries, every single one is made using this base. The only adjusting flavours will ever be salt and chilli. They're the only two things I would use to change my curries.
So essentially all you're doing is changing the ingredients, the natural ingredients, not the sauce itself.
No, and that's what Indians mums do.
So is that what you've done with the chicken then?
Is the butter chicken exactly the same sauce?
Really? It's a very different colour.
Can we have a little taste, Ollie, I think? I don't want you to, you know...
I haven't touched it yet.
No, no surprise.
And while they're dishing that up, I just wanted to ask, are the spices that go into the mix, do they start off as whole spices or do they start off as powders?
So in my curry masala, the base is garam masala. So garam masala, which is, I make from scratch myself. So I clean the spices myself, buy them whole, clean them up, and then I roast what needs to roast, grind them, and then turn the garam masala into curry masala using turmeric and chilies, paprika, all sorts of things go into. So it starts with a home blend of garam masala.
Because garam masala isn't a spice like turmeric is a spice. It's a mix, a blend, right?
Yeah.
So the traditional garam masala has cardamom seeds, I always think, because I always find that nice sort of... You know, a sourness with cardamom seeds. Normally cumin, coriander, cloves, pepper. That's the normal type that you get in garam masala. So garam masala isn't a spice in itself. It's a basic mixture.
I find in modern Britain, in the garam masalas that are available, is they have star anise in them. Indian cooking wouldn't use, our mums wouldn't use star anise.
It's very, very strong as well. It completely changes all the flavour.
I'll use it because I'm modern and I'm modern day British, and I'm changing things and using my spices as I need them. But I only use it to marry it up with tamarind, and just a tiny bit, again, because it is very dominant, but I think it just goes lovely with tamarind. So that's the only time I use
tamarind's got that slight,
like a sourness,
limey sourness to it, hasn't it? It doesn't taste like anything else, tamarind, does it?
No.
In India, would you say people are making their own garam masala?
Of course. I make this garam masala that I sell, I make myself.
And that is mass. People would do that generally in India.
Yes. Our mums are still doing it. And my sister-in-law's in my generation doing it. And I don't know where my niece is. They probably take it from their mum, you know, my sister-in-law's, because we've got two nieces that are married now.
Can I just say, that chicken curry is probably one of the best chicken curries I've ever had.
Oh, this
is
very good.
It's the, what have you done with the chicken? God, it absolutely melts in your mouth.
40 minutes.
Mm-hmm. 40 minutes.
I made that.
So how did you do the, we're jumping all over the place on this. We're not really sticking to one subject, are we? So how did you cook the chicken to make it that moist? Lucy, you got to have, Lucy's the producer sitting at the end. You've got to have some of that. Quite, get your plate over.
If you go to my website, the recipe is on my website, www.leginamasala.com, butter chicken. Basically,
we'll give you a link on the Food Talk website, obviously, as
well. Thank you. Yeah. I invented this because I had a client who wanted chicken curry in a team building exercise, but she didn't like onions. She couldn't tolerate onions. And the only chicken curry I could think of without onions that would work was butter chicken. So I invent, and actually it doesn't need the normal cooking in one place, cook a sauce and put it together. It's actually the cooking of the chicken within the sauce that makes it so moist.
And is it on the bone as well?
I made it on the bone, and then I knew it would be...
that's the difference.
Yeah. I knew it would be awkward, so I've taken it off the bone for you guys here.
She's lovely, isn't she? I'm really getting to like her.
Can you come back next week as well?
Yeah. Come every week. Okay, so every week. So we've got, you've got your garam masala, and that's in a spice mix, and people can get hold of that.
You can buy my curry. You can buy six different spices online.
Yeah. And do you use... So you use that in every single curry that you make, practically?
Not practically, I do.
You do,
curry
right.
masala, for me, I do.
Yeah.
But I realised as I was going through the business that I have clients that do not eat with ginger and garlic. So I created a cardamom mix, which is another curry masala, but it's got no ginger and garlic in it, especially for those clients.
Yeah. And these are little packets, and you use the whole pouch, serves up to sort of six people. And in that butter chicken you've got, so you've got your basic masala, you then might add some other bits that you like, but that's got tomatoes and again fresh coriander leaves, anything you could find really, you could add to that.
So the butter chicken basically is fresh ginger garlic, grated, fried off, I use sunflower oil, then the marinated chicken is added, and I've added to the ginger garlic and sautéed into that pan. Passata is then into the chicken and then finished with fresh coriander.
Really easy.
And I added some butter as well because it's butter chicken.
Yeah. I mean, and the thing that strikes me, which I top tip, I think, because I don't do this, is get some chicken on the bone.
That's it.
And actually cook the chicken in the sauce. Don't fry it separately or anything like that because you'll lose all that moisture. And then if you've got people who don't like fiddling around with bones, just take those out before you start, and then put them back in the sauce.
That's right. That's what I did.
And thighs and legs, good for curry, rather than the chicken breast, which is a bit dry sometimes.
Our British nation, we're obsessed with chicken breast.
And it's bizarre.
It's true. It's dry.
It's got less flavour.
It's really dry.
But what's fascinating about my business is the fact that I've taught a two-year-old to make red dal raita. So he's picked the mint leaves, he's learned to wash them, he's dried them, put them through a little mincer, mixed them together, 2 years old. And he was engaged all the way through.
Well, kids love cooking, generally. They just love it. Just stand them on a chair, you know, get a little apron around them and
give them a knife.
Get them to join in. I used to give my kids knives. Let them join in. It's good.
I've also had a three-year-old make bhajis with me.
Hmm.
And I remember when his parents rang me, I said, I can't do that. I've got a business. 3 years old. We're frying. He did.
Yeah.
He did it. I was terrified. I was absolutely...
But they will do as they're told because it's new and different. If you do say, this is the rules, you don't do this, you do, you know, blah, blah, they really do follow the rules. I think they're really good.
Probably more so if you're not with the parent because, you know, they've almost learnt to ignore the parents, whereas somebody new is in a position of authority.
So can I talk naan bread then? Is naan bread an actual Indian thing or is it just a British thing? Can I taste some of yours?
It's Punjabi. So all the food that we've got today... is Punjabi food. So I'm from Punjab. I haven't brought anything in that isn't from our region. And naan bread is Punjabi. although our mums don't make it because it's traditionally made.
It's like paratha, though, because it's...
Yeah, parathas are made at home, but these aren't because of the cooking them in a tandoor oven traditionally.
Yeah.
So this is kind of, again, this recipe is online.
So how do you make these then?
I can see the melted butter on top and it looks so good.
I'm so sure I could be a vegan for a month or two.
Temporary.
Mm.
If you give me...
don't spoil him. No.
We'll dab it off.
We'll talk afterwards. I'll give you my card.
Me and Ollie are really enjoying this by you not having any. It's brilliant. Explain how you make these then.
So I just make them as a bread dough. When I when I had my son, who's Sam, who's now 20, I decided that we were told at that time the best thing to do is feed your children from scratch. And that's when I started learning to cook.
Definitely.
I couldn't cook before then. So I would make naans up because we liked to order them when we went out for dinner. And actually, it's just like a very simple bread recipe where I add a little bit of baking powder to make sure they rise and I just cook them on the top. If I put them in the oven, I forget about them and they burn and they become crispy. And I just cook them on my dove, on my flat pan, on the top, just like as I do a chapati.
And just try and get it as hot as possible.
That's it.
Get that little burny little bits on the outside.
Yeah. So what we essentially what we're doing is taking a fancy restaurant style back home to cook for my client.
Deconstructing it and making it easy.
That's it. Mm. So that they are cooking together once or twice, three or four times a week, really. But we're eating three meals a day, seven times a week, and we should be cooking from scratch occasionally, is what I believe.
Mm.
And to cook together as a family is so social.
Mm,
it's absolutely so important. And I think my message is kind of getting mixed up with how wonderful the food is, but actually it's not that special. It's just home cooking.
Well, I think it's just, it's
so rare to experience these things, especially for lunch in London. You know, you don't have a home cooked meal. You have something from a sandwich shop.
Mm. Did you like the butter chicken?
Delicious.
It was really good.
The truth is, Indian food isn't that hard to cook.
Oh.
And it is one of those ones that if you just understand the basics and you understand how to, you know, mix the spices right and create the sauces, it's really simple. And actually, it tastes even better the day after. Mm. So actually, it does really play into, you know, batch cooking on a weekend. Mm. You get some stuff done.
Because I find if you freeze curry, it just tastes even better when you unfreeze it.
Well, I talk about this, my ready meals. What I do is when I make dals up, I just stick them in the freezer and we're 5-6 minutes away from a really good dal. And they are just as good once...
Mm.
I think they are just as good. And it's so healthy and cheap and yummy.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I've just come back from... I've been to Seattle for 3 or 4 weeks. They've got a huge, big Whole Food market out there. We've got a couple here in the UK, a couple in London. What really, really struck me, and first of all, I think there's a difference, though, between prices. So I found food prices in America staggering. Now, whether that was just Seattle, I don't know. I found...
They are high.
Really, really high compared to us. Now, I don't know whether we've got artificially, you know, low prices. This is just for fresh food, you know, apples, banana, you know, vegetables, you name it, and meat and things. Really, really expensive. And yet, it was not that much more expensive to get a takeaway meal at Whole Foods. So the differential's not very much. And therefore, all you saw all day long was people going in and having their lunch, having their breakfast, taking their families, actually eating a meal like this that we've just had in Whole Foods or other people, because actually, to be honest, by the time you use your electricity and you've done this and you've done that,
and
it really wasn't much different. And then Whole Foods in Seattle now, there's massive, it's huge. All the different sorts of things that you can you know, spoon on your plate. And it's like a food court, but actually it's all
like
home-cooked.
Like a buffet style.
All home-cooked stuff, yeah.
Mm.
And a lot of it very, very, very healthy. And I was stunned by that. We don't really have that in the UK.
We don't.
And I think it might be because buying food from scratch is actually quite cheap, whereas it isn't in America.
I don't think it's cheap here, but...
But they've also got more of a takeaway culture. I mean, there's more of that, you know, ordering out, eating out, the sort of fast food sort of thing. So in some ways, what you're seeing Whole Foods do there is making their current model more healthy,
yeah,
and bring it closer to kind
and
of
feels
raw
like a meal. So you can get, like, I don't know, 30 choices for breakfast. You know, here, if you went to a cafe, it would be fried egg, sausage, bacon. No, no, they had all these choices, beautiful granola, porridge, you know, eggs, you know, all scrambled eggs with all sorts of nice vegetables and all sorts of stuff that you could have for breakfast, you know, any type of thing. And the same with lunch, the same with dinner. And I wonder if that's a trend that might come over here, where I don't know if you go to St Pancras Station, they've got a little sort of deli thing there. More and more people seem to be taking those things on the way home to eat. You know, not you know, sort of microwave meals, but just stuff that we've got here cooked by somebody, all fresh, and then taking it home.
I think that would be a good trend to see, because so much of the convenience food here is pretty terrible. It's full of salt, additives, full of sugar, full of fat, and it's, you know, doesn't taste very nice, and it's expensive for what it is.
But isn't there a tension between sort of the more niche home-cooked stuff that people are doing? So you have one person who's creating wonderful meals, and you can buy that, and you can, you know, the original kind of, you know, someone who has a, you know, is a good cook, and they kind of supply some of their neighbours with stuff, and there's a financial transaction there of sorts. But once you get into the mass-produced stuff that's available in the supermarkets, of course it's full of everything, because in order to stabilise it, to have best before dates,
and to make it profitable.
But
what I found is interesting is it means that at Whole Foods Market in Seattle, they must have a massive team of chefs all day, who are just cooking all day long, shoving it out.
What happens about family life?
A lot of them were sitting around tables together eating, actually.
Okay.
A lot of people taking their family there to have their tea, you know.
But if you're at
after
home,
school.
our best family times are spent in the kitchen while I'm cooking and Sam's guiding me through whatever he wants or telling me, or just talking to me about the day.
And so just to put it in context, Sam's in the studio next to his mum. He hasn't got a microphone. Hi, Sam. He's a bit of an influence there, isn't he? Yeah.
But what happens about
but
that?
I'm with you. I think the thing that really, you know, there's obviously a role for out-of-home eating. That's clear. Yeah. It's a time off for whoever's the main cook in the home. But I think there's something really special about it. You get the family around the table, everyone's involved in the cooking, you know, it's about understanding, it's about eating. Mm. And I agree, I mean, look.
But that's if you do have a family, Ollie.
Yeah.
And so many people don't, you do like, are not living true. in that sort of, you know, nuclear family set, really. Julie Bennett, you're a futurist. Have you got some comments on that? Are you seeing any of that at all?
Well, I think I'm also American, I think you have some very big differences in car culture, commuting culture, work hours, as well as the way that children's activities are structured in the U.S. that also make kind of dinner time a bit different. Mm. We've very much kept Americans tend to eat as a family around six, everybody, you know, rather than you don't get this difference between feeding the kids tea at 4:30 or 5, putting them to bed, people getting home from a long commute, having a second meal. So there's a lot more emphasis on you know, I think families cooking and eating together at the same time than I've seen in the UK. But also...
The thing is, if you try and book a restaurant in America, over here you can't get a table at 8 o'clock because it's packed. Over there you can't get a table at 6.
Exactly.
It's hilarious. So we'd always go and eat at 8:30. There's nobody there. Brilliant.
If you go to Europe, you can't get a table at 9 or 10.
Yes, exactly. Different culture in
so
that
yeah,
respect.
Exactly. So you can't separate food from the bigger cultural context and all of the infrastructure, the way people earn their living, the way they get around, the way they educate their kids. All of that has a huge influence on how we eat.
But if you are living on your own and say you're a chap and you're a little bit older and maybe you're not very good at cooking, it does make sense to go into somewhere like Whole Food and get a proper meal, in essence, that's been prepared and it's got loads of veg in it and, you know, it's sort of healthy. Better than some takeaway, I guess. Although, is it a takeaway? No, it's out of home eating, isn't it? So it's all changing, I think. I think it's really quite interesting.
Very interesting.
Yeah, anyway, Legina, if we go back to your... You've got all these lovely... curry mixes. You've won the most innovative business award as well for your business. Is that because you've got an accountancy background? You really know what you're doing. And we can order these packs online, can't we? So what spices have you got there?
So there's six blends that I have. The curry masala, garam masala, which is a home blend, cardamom mix, which is the curry mix without the ginger garlic, tandoori masala, which I was asked to make. There's chaat masala, and then my the best one is Chef Crush, which I've got a crush on a chef, so I invented Chef Crush for him.
What's in that?
It's just crushed spices, black pepper, coriander seeds, fennel seeds, cumin seeds. And it was, I saw him making a steak online, and I just thought, right, I'm going to do an equivalent. And actually, it's really lovely because you can put it into pasta dishes, all sorts of different dishes, and it acts almost like a stock. It's really quite bizarre.
And you've got loads of recipes, haven't you, on your website and stuff? So you can get these sort of spice packs, and then you can look at the recipes and muck around with it. The real thing is about roasting them, isn't it, and getting them whole, and that's what you take all that work out of.
It's understanding that. And when I go to clients' houses to teach them to cook, I always do a spice audit. And when I look at the dates, there's
spice
jars of
audit. Oh, please don't do that in my house. I think I've had one where I've moved house twice and taken the same thing.
Yeah, I think I've got that as well.
Fenugreek.
Oh, I love fenugreek. It's great.
Mm. I mean, some of them are solid. I mean, they're actually completely solidified. But
good shake.
Turn the spoon upside down up here and give it a little poke.
Yeah.
So how long should you keep them for? I mean, they obviously have a best by date, but they're not going to harm you if you have them too long.
Actually, when my spices went to be shelf life tested, I was told that they would never go off. It's just a...
They won't kill you, won't they? Yeah. I mean, you can probably have them 100 years later. Not going to kill you, but it probably won't taste
anything.
They're
not going to be the best.
No, you lose the flavour.
Yeah. Mm. So when should you do a spice audit? I mean, would we say to everybody, come on, you should all do a spice audit maybe once or twice a year? No, once a year, just to chuck out anything that's been there too long and keep stuff in the dark? Is that right?
Yeah, I keep mine in the dark. And I just use... Mind you, mine doesn't get... Mine wouldn't have a chance because I'm just using them
all the time. Yeah,
all the time.
Mm. Well, thank you so much for bringing our lunch in. I'm gonna have a little bit. I'm gonna eat some more chicken. Are you gonna?
I can tell you.
Are you gonna?
I'm there.
You're gonna go for it. Yeah. So should we have a little break and then we can have a little bit of lunch? And then I think a really good idea then is then we're gonna come back to Julie Bennett of Precipice Design and have a talk about the future. So we're gonna have a break for a little minute. Thank you, Lugina. This is lovely. Thank you so much.
Delicious.
Yeah, see you in a minute. Hello there, my name is Sue Nelson and I'm the presenter on the Food Talk Show. Last year, in June, we held our first Food Talk Awards. We had the most incredible time. We had amazing people applying for the awards. It allowed them to market themselves better. It allowed them to get new business. It allowed them to get new buyers. And generally, it did their business the world of good. I'd really like you to apply this year if you're doing something new and interesting. We've got all sorts of categories, from just stuff that tastes amazing to free from food. Food that's really been designed for clean eating, taking everything nasty out of it. Or you might have a smart kitchen gadget, or you're doing amazing things in the world of packaging. We'd love you to apply. The closing date is Friday the 16th of February, midnight, in case you're one of those people who leave it to the last minute. And we really do feel it gives people the most incredible publicity. Not only do you get a shiny gold award and the right to call yourself a Food Talk Award winner, we will feature you in an episode of the Food Talk Show, which would be great. It means you can join us here in our studio. So please do consider entering the Food Talk Awards. You've got till Friday the 16th of February, and you need to go on to our website, which is foodtalkawards.com, or just go on to our foodtalk.co.uk site and you'll find all about it there. Good luck. Make sure you apply. So we've just finished our lunch in the studio, polished off the lentils.
Really quite delicious.
And
it
the
was.
Chicken curry and naan bread and the pakora, and there was a little tamarind drizzly thing as well. Thank you so much. Oh, Lugina. Lucy, our producer, said that she wanted to go home and live with Lugina. Only if I get there first, Lucy. So thank you very much. And you can get any of those lovely spices at luginamasala.com. And Lugina is spelled L-A-J-I-N-A. And you'll get a link on the Food Talk website. So heartily, heartily recommend that. Julie Bennett is a guest in the studio. Could not believe her luck that she's turned up on a week we're eating Indian.
Very good day.
You're pleased with that, weren't you?
Very good day.
Luckily for us, you've brought some drinks along, which is a pretty good way to end, you know. know, after our meal. So Julie, just explain a little bit about your day job. What exactly is that you do?
Well, I'm very, very lucky because I get to work with amazing social scientists and cultural analysts to really understand people, how we live, how we relate to the world, how we make sense of the world. And I also get to work with leading scientists and technologists to figure out kind of what's coming down the road. And even better is then I get to create stories about what the future should be. Because actually, the future isn't predetermined. We make the future by the stories that we tell ourselves about the future. And so by the stories that we tell, the things that we imagine, the products that we make, we're actually shaping the future that's going to come. And we're making it in the way that'll work for us.
So are you saying that if you write these stories up and if you extrapolate them and create what you think will be the future, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy and we end up creating that anyway? Or have I got the wrong end of the stick?
Well, it shapes our expectations, it shapes our understanding, but it also helps us grapple with the complications, right? So once you take technology and you take it out of the PowerPoint and CES and that, you know, and then you start thinking about how would you really live with that? What are the downsides as well as the upsides? You can make different choices about how you make the technology so that you kind of make it kind of purpose fit for the richness of life.
And so what you do is you take a huge number of different types of readings, as it were, and signs and all sorts of stuff. And then you, in your head, try and work out what that will mean and what it will be like and how we'll react to it and how we'll interact with it.
But yeah, it's partly in the head, partly on big walls. We have very big walls in the studio. And it's also about making stuff. So, you know, we're a design company. So we imagine stuff and then we make it. Mm. And you learn through that process as well.
So, Ollie, you do a lot of research for Great British Chefs. I would say that's what's like state of the nation research. You know, this is where we are at the moment. Do you extrapolate that forward at all? Or do you just report where we are?
It depends on which consumer group we're talking to. So if we're looking at a national sample, the one we're running at the moment for 3,000 people, that will tell you where we are today. But when you dig deeper into particular consumer groups and understand their particular food habits, then you can see where trends are emerging. So it's clear from the data set that we have that we can identify the trendsetters, what they're adopting, what they're not adopting. So, for example, in the recent research we did, it looks like about 20% of foodies are now adopting a more plant-based diet.
Now, wow, that much?
That is massive compared to what we expected. We're still playing with the data. We're not totally there yet.
So you're spotting trends early, but it's about what people are doing, though.
But it's also about identifying what people are doing and identifying who is that person and what are their other attitudes, because ultimately you can spot a trend by looking at the whole population and then digging deeper into the trendsetters. And the people who visit our site regularly, you know, the foodies, are ultimately ahead of the curve on adopting new processes.
So you can flag up little warning signals, really, and say, look, this is what's happening over here. Don't know why, but this is what's happening.
Absolutely. And then we often dig deeper into it in order to try and understand it and try and understand where things are going. So you see it with the emergence of new styles of cooking, you see it with the emergence of new ingredients, new approaches, new philosophies, you know, and all that kind of stuff.
And so, Julie, but you go much further than that, don't you? Mm. You take those early warning signs.
We're often working 5, 10, 15, 20 years in the future. So,
wow.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
And it's not just food stuff, is it? You work kind of across lots of different sectors, but food is obviously one of the things that you do work on.
Absolutely. So we work in food, we work in medical devices, pharmaceuticals, consumer electronics, furniture, plumbing, but food and drink. Plumbing.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Whatever. I'm not sure what the future of plumbing is, but I'm not sure I even want to know what the future of plumbing is.
Does it involve plugs? No.
Maybe it might involve a non-Victorian plumbing system as we have in London.
Yeah, possibly.
It's going to have to at some point, isn't it?
So in terms of food, you've brought a few things along with you. Why have you brought those things along with you? Is it part of some of the trends that you're predicting?
Well, so I think, and I think this is a really interesting conversation, the difference between kind of trends and the future. Because, some of these represent trends that we're seeing, and then some of them actually are bridges to the future. So I think, particularly when we start thinking about the future, these little things are really interesting. We have one for calming the brain.
So these are little bottles.
With a little bit of CBD oil.
What is CBD?
It's one of the compounds in cannabis. It's not the bit that makes you high, but it's the bit that.
Oh, sorry.
You are on the radio.
So we're on live radio.
I've never had cannabis, actually. I was going to whiz it over. I thought, oh, I'll have a go at that. Because like New Year's resolution, you should try new things.
Yeah. That's a great excuse.
We're in February.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, it's early days. And I still haven't done cannabis yet. So, and I'm 56. It's about time.
Head back to California.
but you know, California is driving an incredible amount of research and it's this consumption of stuff. But yeah, CBD, good for the brain. We have the one that's...
To say that in California now, you can just go and buy weed, can't you, in shops?
Yeah.
So I was standing outside a bus stop because I'd researched to catch this bus. There's a couple of blokes like just come out of that shop and were really dragging on one of these, whatever they call them. God, they
lifts.
That's it. They were so high, and it's like wafting over. You can smell it. Like,
to be fair, that happens in Shoreditch, and it's not legal here.
Does it happen in Shoreditch? Oh, must. But it felt a bit weird that somehow you can just go into what's called a weed shop and go and buy whatever you wanted. That will come over here, surely.
It's much more convenient.
It'll come over here at some point.
Because it starts to make you think about the very specific functionality of the things that you're consuming. And that's one of the most important things to start thinking about, is that biology is becoming data. And that means that everything that goes on in the natural world, in our bodies, in plants, in animals, in the environment, we're starting to turn into data sets. So we're beginning to model and map. And then we're, as the computing power grows and grows, we're simulating. So in the future, you will be able to have an individual simulation of your body on a chip.
And what suits you and what doesn't?
Yeah,
what helps your health and what doesn't, and what harms your health, what harms your gut, you know, whatever, what suits you?
Because currently, these systems are so complex, you can only really find stuff out over 20, 30, 40-year epidemiological studies. And those are just for a general population. And so in the future...
And we're also incredibly different.
Exactly. If you look at just the difference in your microbiome, the gut, the bacteria that's in your body, that's entirely personal to you. It's like your own world.
It's like DNA. Yeah.
Based on where you grew up as well.
Exactly. And so, it'll take time and money and resources to get to that point where we've got these simulations and where you can model everything that's going on in your body. But it will happen, and it will happen faster than we think. If you just let the future of what food means in that future kind of be left to kind of the tech bros and Silicon Valley, it might not be the future you want to have.
Right.
And so it's really important to think about how, we know food is nourishment, we know food is love, we know food is identity, it's how we express ourselves, it's how we...
I mean, that's very much what you've been saying, Lagina, isn't it?
Exactly.
Food is about identity, it's about love, it's about sharing, it's about learning. We don't want it just to be a tech thing, do we?
Exactly. If it's just down to, garbage in, garbage out.
Well, one example of that, which we've already seen, is products like Soylent and Huel, which are basically a techie's answer to the nutrient inputs that you need, and they're completely removing the enjoyment factor of, cooking or eating. I mean, it's everything that you need in a powder that you just shake up with some water and you drink it.
I can't think of anything more depressing than that. Nothing more depressing than that.
That tells my point about the stories, exactly. Because if you think about what are the science fiction stories that we have of food, there's basically two, right? There's the replicator in Star Trek, and there's Blade Runner, right? Mm. And you don't see food in these stories of the future very often. Mm. And so if we don't start writing these stories, if we don't think about what we want food to be, that's what we're going to be stuck with is one or two kind of limited explorations.
A joyless future where, I mean, we've just had such a lovely time eating Lagina's curry and talking about it and smiling and taking the mickey out of Guy, obviously. I can't imagine not having food at the centre of that, of a social life, if you know what I mean.
But there's a question about how much of that becomes an experience that the wealthy can afford to enjoy, because
and
there's
not
obviously
anybody else.
Malnutrition, there's people eating the wrong things. So on some ways one has to differentiate between the different consumer groups here, because I think it's very clear from the 1970s the attempt to mechanize food and move us towards a more kind of ready meal based solution failed, because it failed
Thank
on
God.
pleasure.
Yeah.
And I think that pleasure will always be at the heart of some people's eating
physically doing you harm, actually.
Yes, absolutely, because they took it the wrong way. But that was a mistake in their execution. Mm.
But what you're trying to say then, Julie, is if we can shape those stories a little bit better, we won't make those sorts of mistakes, or try not to anyway, or you could try and steer the future.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Sorry. I was going to, just kind of on that point, I was saying it's almost like you're looking into the future now to see what happens if we do it this way, and you can almost project it forward and model it and say, well, do we want to live in this reality, or do we want to tweak it a little bit now and live in this other reality over here, which is a really interesting concept.
Because you can really change the direction.
Exactly.
By those small things.
And I think right now, In this stuff that we start to call functional food or personal food, it's so individual, right? We're just really focusing on optimizing individual consumption. I think the power of the technology will be when the technology is so powerful, can step aside and it can optimize social interaction, cultural interaction, environmental interaction. And so we're not just optimizing for what's good for, you know, you can get what's good for me in this moment, but you can also get what's good
for a family and encouraging debate and talking and sharing. So what have you got with you?
So some of the other things I brought with me are a little bit more trend based. And one of the trends that we're seeing at the moment really, really strongly is a switch from kind of sweet and fruit based flavors to more savory, bitter and vegetable based flavors. And so kind of, probably in the past, when it's a cocktail bar, most of the drinks would be...
Oh, you get fruit-based. Oh, what's it called? That, like Baileys and, and cream and big fruit punch with an umbrella in it. Yeah, that's not the future.
Yeah, and I brought some seed lip in with me, which is trendy in a number of ways because it's basically a non-alcoholic botanical spirit. So it looks like a high-end gin. It talks about itself like a gin. It is very much
like a gin.
Costs like a gin.
It's owned by Diageo.
Yes.
Now.
Yeah, that must have been fairly recent.
So if from an identity perspective, this is kind of your perfect placebo for Dry January, because you can, you know.
So Lucy, producer sitting at the end there, pour us a couple, will you? Please, old chap.
But
thank you.
You'll also note these flavours are very...
Not that one, because I've had that one before, it's horrible.
Yeah.
Can I try that one?
Yeah.
You're still on the radio, Sue.
It is. Have you not tried it?
I've not. It's something that I've been meaning to try for a long time.
There's two seed lips. So I was stunned at how expensive they are for a start. It's the same price as gin. It's quite expensive.
Do you want the tonic with it?
Yes, please. I tried.
Why shouldn't it be? I mean, because in the end, their argument is that it's not the ethanol that's
still
costing the money.
Botanicals.
It's the processing and it's the ingredients.
Okay, fair enough.
So, I mean, I agree with that reaction. But yeah. I'm kind of.
No, fair enough. That's a good point. One of them's very. What's it called, Julie?
This is Garden 108.
So the gardeny one. This is one I've got here. Yeah. I haven't had this one. This is very leaf one. Then the other one is, what's that one, Lucy? It's
Spice 94.
Oh, I thought that was appalling.
Yeah.
But can you taste that one, Ollie, and see what you think? Have you tried it?
Because you like a bit of spice, don't you?
I do like a bit of spice. I'm happy to be a guinea pig.
Would you like to try some, Gina?
And
it's not alcoholic.
You have a shot of it, do you? Like a similar kind of measure?
I mean, you can treat it just like gin, or to be fair, you could mix it with gin too.
If you're having a rough day.
See, the botanicals are very, very strong, I think.
Maybe because you've not got much tonic in there.
No. Well, Ollie, you know, you've worked with big brands. What do you think about that?
It's not for me.
No, it's horrible, isn't it?
Well, no, it's interesting. It's not...
What a taste. If you're doing vegan.
Just to give an example, I mean, you know, I love a good elderflower cordial. I mean, I'm not against in any way at all.
Elderflower cordial.
You know, really good fruit juices, really good stuff. But that doesn't work for me.
It's very medicinal. It reminds me of some kind of cough mixture, but obviously it's completely clear.
So I've just tasted the gardeny one, and again, for me, I really don't like it. It's got a horrible aftertaste, which is hanging around a lot in my mouth.
And
I don't like it.
Which guy? Are you on the same one I'm on? The spice.
I think the spiced one. Yeah.
For me, it actually almost smells like a. There's almost like a hint and a memory of cough medicine in there.
Yeah.
And it's
not pleasant. Regina, you're good at food. Which one have you got?
And spices, of course.
Which one have you got?
Spice.
You've got a spicy one. Try the garden one, Ollie. There's just something
it's
about
it. It's not terrible. There's something about it that
when you put it to your nose, it's really interesting. You get that real green floral freshness.
It smells great. It doesn't taste great. Which is, I thought, quite interesting. Do you like it?
Thyme is coming through for me.
Oh, I prefer that.
It's nicer. That one's definitely nice. The leafy one, whatever it is, the garden one's nicer. But anyway, while we're slagging this one off, the your point is that people are really looking for non-alcoholic alternatives that are grown up and feel like you could, you know.
And also different flavour profiles that are much more savoury, much more kind of vegetable and botanical based. And I think one of the things that tasting those versus what the other thing I brought really highlights is that it's not just kind of the flavour and the liquid that gives you the experience of a great drink. It's the sensory perception, right? And so what you're missing without the alcohol is the different kind of liveliness and different parts of the tongue and kind of awakening. Waking those flavours in a different way.
It has that all grown up thing going on, you know, as it's a little bit complex and all that. You know, it's not just a fruit juice. So I do get that. I've still got a dreadful aftertaste.
Yeah.
Can I try the other one to try and like you know, minimise the effect?
The
one that's 42%.
Is it really?
So this is not dry.
Sorry, 40.
This is a chili poblano liqueur.
Pass my glass along.
That's good.
And why are you highlighting that? Is it again the chili thing?
You can have more if you like.
No, definitely not. I'm supposed to be working.
Because I think this is really where it goes beyond flavour to sensory. Kind of the way that it smells sets your stomach up in one way.
Ollie, you'll like that.
Is it spicy as well as boozy?
That's really nice.
Sue's just fallen off her chair.
That is so nice.
To me, it's like after you have a really spicy dish, it's not the burn, it's that glow you get after the burn where you just want more.
I want more of that. Yeah. You not drink all of that, I want some more. How nice is that? Now that's gone up into my nasal passages, my head and... It's really, really nice. I wasn't going to drink during the week. I've just blown that. Do you like it? You like
it? That was for work, so it doesn't count.
No,
yeah. Okay.
You know, you could have had the chicken.
I could have had some chicken because it was for work.
I really like that. Yeah. That's given me loads of hits all over the place. I like the taste. Do you not like it?
I have to say, though, I think the whole just taking us back to Seedlip. You know, Seedlip are, you know, real innovators in the sense that they are really the first brand that has tried to create a grown-up, I'm going to call it spirit, you know, a spirit competitor. And look, I think what they're doing is really, really interesting. And I think over time, better and more interesting flavours or flavours that appeal to those of us who drink gins and drink vodkas and drink whiskies will emerge. And I think it's been a really, really, really interesting category to see how it evolves.
I admire what they're doing, Ollie. I mean, I've been a bit flippant about the taste, but I really admire them trying to do it. I do, you know, and good for them. You know, they're really trying hard.
And if the truth is, if you walk into your average British pub and you want not to drink, your options are diabolical.
Dreadful. They're dreadful.
It's J2O, it's Coca-Cola or Pepsi, and it's water. And occasionally they'll have juice, but it's probably not great quality juice. And you just I applaud what they're doing, but I think there's so much space in this area. And also, it's not a heavy sugar based thing. I mean, there's lots of stuff that makes it interesting as a category.
I've seen it in a couple of pubs actually. I just never gotten around to trying it.
I'm just looking at Legina, who's just gone for a little bit of the what's it called again, Julie?
It's a chili thing, is it?
Chili something or other.
Yes, chili poblano liqueur.
Chili poblano liqueur. And your thoughts?
I think I need to take the bottle home.
Yeah, I'd like it as well.
Trade it for some spices.
Yeah.
I could spice your next one up for you.
But I think, you know, what they're trying to do kind of feeds back into the trend you were talking about with plant-based eating, the vegan stuff, is that it's not about what you consume being putting you in a box for life, but what do I need to eat today to be who I need to be today? And sometimes who you need to be today is plant-based, sometimes it's alcoholic, sometimes it's non-alcoholic. And that, you know, that reinventing yourself and your identity through your food and your consumption every day, every meal, every group of people that you're with, like you're saying, it's for work, it's not for work. That's really going to be driving a lot of what we see over the next few years.
And those shots that you had earlier, I was seeing a lot of those in supermarkets at the moment where you get a shot of turmeric or a shot of ginger and you've got a couple there. Again, do you think that's people saying, oh, I just want a blast of that in a very convenient way? They're not cheap, are they?
They're not cheap, but these go much deeper to the heart of functionality. So, this one is, I can't read it because I'm getting too old, but about brain function. So cognitive enhancement is a major, major trend to be looking out for over the next few years.
Helping people to concentrate longer?
Yellow text on white, to be fair, which would make it hard for anyone to.
But helping you think better, remember better. And
the opposite of that chili liqueur, to be honest.
So is this produced by a brand that's readily available in the UK?
Yeah, so this is just down the road at the High-Low Mood Food.
High-low mood food?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
High-low mood food. So you go in there and go, I want to be low today.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm feeling way too optimistic about the state of the country and how Brexit is going. Apparently Theresa May is taking it every day because things are going so well.
Yes, exactly.
So make she's me
probably,
lower.
Yeah, she's probably a client. But what you're saying is there is a trend.
Yeah.
Could we get a box of it and send it to her?
Yeah, that'd be a great idea.
The high stuff, I'm suggesting. 10
Downing Street. But what you're saying is that there is definitely a trend for people to try and affect their mood by making choices, food
exactly.
choices.
How you feel, choices. How you think. Yeah. You know, this one is about how your body behaves with your healthy gut, which again we know also affects how you feel and how you behave. Yeah. So it's all interconnected.
But I'm obviously listening to the wrong radio stations. There's a radio ad that appears occasionally which says things like, are you taking over 10 different medicine, pills a day? And it's like, if you take the average over 50-year-old person, a lot of them are taking 10 different pills. So my father-in-law, he's 80, right? When he said, can you go and get these pills for me for my bag? And I opened him up and it literally looked like he was a drug dealer. Hmm. I mean, his entire bag was full of different things. And, the amount of sort of pharmaceuticals we're taking, I could not support more the idea that we start to think more holistically about what goes into our body and how we start to address some of the imbalances in there,
but
rather than just medically.
I think younger
attacking.
People are doing that. Okay. I think they're thinking like that. But we have got 2 minutes left, unbelievably, Julie. Can you give us your top predictions for the next, let's say, 5 years?
The next 5 years.
In the UK, basically.
Cognitive enhancement is definitely one of them. So how food impacts our thinking and our feeling. I think sensory, the sort of really
playing
not
around
just about
with your
flavor,
senses,
but really that deep sensation and kind of 360 from the kind of the smell, kind of how it feels. And I think also, our virtual companions are going to be doing more of our shopping kind of for us and with us. Mm. So thinking about how once we've got kind of algorithms as intermediaries in our shopping cart is also... if you live with Alexa or one of her friends, you start to see how that impacts your consumption.
Alexa. I like Alexa.
Sorry for anyone who's got one and is listening to the show, because she's probably piped up by now.
But if you say, Alexa, people listening, she's gone right off on one now. Yes, brilliant. Well, Julie Bennett from Precipice Design, thank you. If you want to find out more about Precipice Design, it's precipice-design.com. And I presume people can go on there if they're interested in employing your services or just finding out the sorts of work that you're doing.
Absolutely. Lots of interesting stuff to read.
Yeah, some really good articles on there that are quite thought-provoking, I think. And very interesting to talk about trends versus imagining the future being quite
really
a different
like
thing. Yeah, yeah, very, very thought-provoking. And, of course, Legina, I feel a bit better now. You've had a whack of alcohol. I feel like we've adjusted the balance. We've given you something back after you worked so hard and gave us all those lovely meals that you cooked for us. So we really do appreciate that. And again, if you go on to foodtalk.co.uk, we'll have all the links on our website. But it's leginamasala.com. And I've got a little bag of spices you've given me. Thank you so much. Very kind of you. Anything else to add, Guy, very, very quickly?
No, I'm very well satisfied trends, with food and drink today.
Very, very, thank you very interesting. Much, everyone. Thank you for co-hosting, and thank you, Ollie. We'll be getting your research out fairly soon, will we, from Great British Chefs?
We will be doing a whole session of talking about all sorts of things.
So. Absolutely, brilliant. So, you've been listening to The Food Talk Show. We'll see you next week. Please get in touch with us via Twitter on @FoodTalkShow. Or if you want to listen to any of our hundreds of podcasts, go to foodtalk.co.uk. Have a good week. Bye.